Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 2, Video Geek Out with Joe Kane. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync, featuring hands-free calling, music and podcast search, and turn-by-turn navigation. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. Greetings and welcome to Home Theater Geeks. I'm your host, Scott Wilkinson, editor of UltimateAVMag.com and online editor of HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geek is Joe Kane, one of the most respected consultants in the video industry and one of my mentors in all things video. Joe's passion for image quality has led him to start his own company, Joe Kane Productions, and develop a number of test and evaluation discs that have become standard reference material. In addition, he campaigns tirelessly to improve how manufacturers and content providers do things in order to deliver the best possible video image. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and I'm sorry I can't be here in video for some technical problems, but we'll work those out.
We'll work on those, and I'm really sorry you can't be there on video as well for our streaming watchers. But we'll certainly get you back on the show. I want to pick your brain more than we can today, I'm sure, regarding all the stuff that you do. And so we'll have another opportunity in the future, I'm sure, to do that. But thanks for hanging in and being on the phone with us. Let's start.
My pleasure.
Yes, thank you. Well, let's start with, I'd love to start with your philosophy regarding video, because I know you have a very well-defined position on that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
I appreciate the opportunity to say this, because with all the controversy that sometimes surrounds things I have to say, it's welcomed to be able to present why I say the things I do. I firmly believe and understand that our video system is a communication system. And by that, I mean that if there's going to be any communication, there has to be a set of rules. There has to be an understanding of how you're communicating. As an example, if you have a send fax machine and a receive fax machine, if the receive fax machine doesn't understand the language that the transmit machine is sending, there's going to be garbage at the receive end. You won't get the fax that you're supposed to be getting. So if the two machines are playing by the same set of rules, something's going to be lost in between. I happen to have participated on committees that have set the rules for the communication system, and granted, those rules are based on something called affordable technology.
You're talking about the video communication system here, right?
Yes, the video communication system.
Right.
So that, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
As an example, we couldn't set standards around what a laser projector is capable of doing, because that is not a mass communication device. Not a lot of people can afford laser projectors.
I guess so, that's true, yeah.
Therefore, we had to set the rules of the communication system based on what was affordable in consumer technology.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, the communication system isn't everything it could be. It is everything that it can be and still be affordable.
Mm.
Now, with that in mind, and you read all sorts of articles about limitations of this, and one technology can do more than another technology can do.
Right.
The problem with all of that is that if each of these technologies is doing something different, then they're not conforming to the communication system, and what you get is not what the communication system is trying to deliver.
Mm.
And so I get Really particular when I'm out there talking to people, I'm saying the display device has to match the rules of the communication system in order to do the very best job it can do. If it strays in any direction away from the communication system, it doesn't matter what direction it strays, but if it strays in any direction away from the communication system, something is lost. And so that's been the whole premise of everything I've done in the industry, is to try to help people understand that our video system requires rules. Otherwise, there's no way that we could actually communicate. If everybody who is producing program content doesn't produce to the same canvas, in other words, they look at a canvas and observe what they're sending you, and they make adjustments based on how it looks on that canvas. And incidentally, when I say canvas, I'm referring to the display device that they're using.
Right.
But in the post-production world, there is a really good adherence to a single system for creating the program content. And then the artist, the person who's trying to communicate, can make any adjustments they want to make within the limitations of the canvas. And it's almost like, well, all right, we're limited to watercolors because that's what the system does. But in watercolors, you can do some spectacular things.
Sure.
Just as in a canvas, if I limit you to charcoal, there's still a huge amount of things that you can do in charcoal to communicate really interesting pictures.
Sure.
And the same way with our current television system. We have a well-defined canvas, which is well-known in the post-production industry. And so we set that canvas up, and we set the artist in front of that canvas, and we say, go to it. Create whatever you want within the limitations of this canvas.
And then the trick, of course, is to make sure that the canvas that the consumer sees, in fact, conforms to those same rules.
Absolutely. That is what my entire career in the video industry has been all about.
And why do you suppose it's been so difficult to achieve this? I mean, that seems a relatively simple thing. Here's a set of rules. Here's the manufacturer. Go produce TVs and projectors and so on that conform to these rules. And yet so often they don't. Why do you suppose that is?
It's the explanation for that is actually quite simple. It's called competition. That each manufacturer is trying to sell their set over every other set.
Yeah.
So if every set looks the same, which of course it should, if it's going to meet the... system rules, if it's going to adhere to the communication system. So theoretically, if everybody was doing the same thing, you would walk into the store and you would see every single set would be perfectly tuned. And the manufacturers believe that that would actually confuse the consumer. Because how would they know what set, how would they know to pick A over B?
Well, in a way, that would be confusing, because if they all looked identical, it almost wouldn't matter. All you'd have to do would be to go in and say, what size do you want? And it wouldn't matter which company you bought it from.
That's right. And so in the spirit of competition, each manufacturer tries to do something different to get your attention, to say, look at me, I've got brilliant colors, or look at me, I've got a lot of light output. And so they're doing things to the display device that makes it completely different from what it should be in conforming to the communication system.
Right.
It's gotten so bad that from my own going in and talking to manufacturers, they actually lost complete sight of the communication system. there is actually no working knowledge of what that communication system is within many manufacturers.
Really? Amongst the engineering department, they have no no concept of what this system should be?
It's gotten so bad that they don't even know what the communication system is. And I say this, and almost every manufacturer that I've worked with in trying to help them build better TV sets, the first thing I have to do is a basic course in video. Because with the exception of companies that have engineers that have been in the business since the 60s and 70s, if they're any newer than that, I've not found a single person in the engineering department that actually knows what video is.
Wow. That's very discouraging.
Well, we've had a discussion when we moved to high definition. We changed the way we encode red, green, and blue into the component signal, the YCRCB. Mm-hmm. When we went to high definition in 1998, we changed the way we encode that. To this day, 90% of the TV set manufacturers get the decoding process wrong. And when I go in and tell them that it's wrong and show them that it's wrong, they look at me dumbfounded and say, "What do you mean they changed the system?"
They didn't even know that it had changed from SD to HD?
They didn't even know. Well, you see Blu-ray players, when you take the HDMI output and you look at the RGB out of HDMI, that means the Blu-ray player is decoding from the YCRCB signal that's on the disc to the RGB that's required by the display. Almost every single first-generation Blu-ray player that I ever tried got that wrong. Blu-ray hasn't been out that many years. It is a high-definition format, and they got it wrong.
Wow. What about today? Have you seen an improvement in being conforming to these rules?
Every single case where I've brought this to the attention of the manufacturer, it's been fixed. It was only fixed after I brought it to their attention.
Wow. Wow.
So this is called not playing by the rules.
Not even knowing the rules.
Knowing what the rules are.
Yeah.
That's how much sight has been lost of the communication system. And so my job today is much bigger than it ever was.
Seems to be. I mean, certainly when we went from black and white to color, we had a new set of rules, and we went from standard def to high def, then a different set of rules, probably not as profound a difference as from black and white to color, or am I wrong about that?
It's different. We did change the rules when we went to color. We changed the rules when we went to color, and obviously that was a big change. But going the rules of color in high definition changed a little bit. The hoped for result was that high definition would have better color fidelity than the standard definition system.
And by color fidelity, you mean
being able to better, as an example, the change in the equation came about so that it was easier to get more color resolution in the area of flesh tones. The change was made because we wanted more resolution in flesh tones.
To make them more realistic looking.
Yes. So that in color resolution, we would have more steps of color in the area of flesh tones.
By the way, for those who might not know the terms component and RGB, these are different, we would call them color spaces, right? Different ways of representing the three colors, red, green, and blue, which are used to make up all the colors we see on a video display. RGB is more direct. It's just red, green, and blue.
We see in red, green, and blue. So when we capture images, we have to capture red, green, and blue. And it's actually difficult, or before the digital era, it was actually difficult to convey red, green, and blue. It was much easier, and for compatibility purposes, we had to create a black and white signal out of the color signal.
And with black and white TV that had come before.
Yes. And so the color cameras were suddenly suddenly acquiring images in red, green, and blue. The black and white cameras were acquiring images in black and white.
Sure.
Well, in order to be compatible with black and white sets, we had to make the color signal into a black and white signal. But then in order to derive color again in a color set, we had to transmit two more pieces of information. Because if I start out with one and I'm trying to create three, I basically, from your high school math, I need three equations to solve for three unknowns. So if the three unknowns are how much red, green, and blue, I need three equations to solve for that.
Right.
If one of the equations is red plus green plus blue in a various percentage, which equals black and white, then I need two more pieces of information in order to get the color back. And so that's where the component signal, the YCRCB signal, came from.
Y is the black and white part of the signal.
That's correct. And the CR and CB, the CR is basically the red signal minus the black and white signal, and the CB is basically the blue signal minus the black and white. So if you add black and white to the CB signal, you suddenly come up with blue. If you add black and white to the red signal, you suddenly come up with red. Because it's R minus Y, and then if you add Y back to it, the two Ys cancel out, and you're left with R.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
It's math. It's really simple. Well, I won't say really simple math. But
it's simple math at this point, but you drill down a little bit farther, and it gets pretty complicated. I've looked at that stuff, and that's like, holy moly.
Yes, it certainly can be, but in principle, it's all straightforward.
Sure. You mentioned high school math, and I wanted to just touch a moment on how you first became interested in video and electronics. So I remember you telling me a story about when you were in high school actually setting up people's color TVs.
Well, and I'm obviously going to tell everybody what my age is. I was in high school in 1964. 1964 was the year that all three networks went to color. And little things like Hogan's Heroes didn't make it to color until January of 65. And so CBS was the last one to go to color.
Right.
But color TV sets started selling in our neighborhood in 1964. And I was actually one of the people that went out to people's homes, and I actually adjusted the set when they were delivered. I actually did the color calibration and the convergence on TV sets in 64, 65, and 66.
Unbelievable. And that means going in with a tiny little screwdriver and adjusting trim pots and doing all that
That's kind of right.
Yeah,
the old Delta tubes had 30 or 40 trim pots, and you had to go in with a screwdriver to adjust convergence. And I also learned a fundamental way of setting the bias controls and the gain controls. We would wait for a black and white picture to come up, and we would tune those controls until we got a good-looking black and white. And so, you know, it had to be neutral. And I learned that the bias controls control the color of gray down at the bottom end of the scale, and the gain controls controlled the color at the top end. And I remember being highly critical of TV sets by the early 70s. They took those pots off, and they were pre-adjusted using resistors at the factory, and they couldn't be adjusted afterwards. And I remember even in the 70s being upset with manufacturers for not including adjustments.
Wow.
For grayscale.
Right. So you were probably one of the first consumer calibrators in the country, were you not?
Certainly in the colored. The only thing I will say is, of course, that was 10 years after color came out. Color officially came out in 54, and sure. It was 64 before I was doing it. So there certainly were other people out there setting up color TV sets. But
not many, I would say.
No, not many. And one of the other things that I told you that when I was in high school, this was in upstate New York, and we had a Regents system. In order to get into college, you had to take scientific courses. You had to take biology and chemistry. And among the things that you had to take was a language.
Right.
And one of the things that pleased me a great deal is they considered electronics a language.
I love so that.
In my high school, there was an option of taking electronics as a language, and that qualified, my actually taking electronics qualified for the language requirement that I had to have. So instead of taking French or Latin, which were the two courses offered, I took electronics.
I love that. That is so cool. I wish I could have taken electronics as my language in high school.
So it was an interesting option that they allowed electronics in place of a language.
Yeah. Now, go ahead.
No, it just amused me that I never took the language, but I got a recent scholarship anyway.
Now, as a calibrator in high school, you then, of course, continued to do that. And if I'm not mistaken, you were one of or the founder of the Imaging Science Foundation. Isn't that correct?
Yes. That all got started with my work as an editor at a magazine. Mm. And in this work in doing editing, we were among the first to publish articles saying that particular TV sets didn't look all that good on the showroom floor, but they could be calibrated to look really good. And we set ProScan on the map.
ProScan was the high-end brand of RCA, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct. And they, they were certainly set up to compete on the showroom floor. Mm-hmm. And I recognized that they had enough control in them to be dialed back so that they could be really good performers. And the interesting thing is the marketing department at ProScan knew nothing of this. Hmm. And so what I did is in the magazine, I had the reviewer do a pre-calibration evaluation of the set and a post-calibration evaluation of the set. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the post-calibration evaluation came out spectacular, which is part of what set ProScan on the map. Mm. Now, when I went to Indianapolis, which is where RCA was centered, the marketing people wanted to know how I found this out. And I had requested a joint meeting of the engineers and marketing together. And what came out in that meeting is the engineers were the 1950s engineers who were in the very first days of color television.
They knew the rules.
By the 90s, they knew they were at the tail end of their ability to control anything that was going on in TV sets. Mm. So in the late 80s, early 90s, when the ProScan came on the market, what they did is they built the set right, and then put enough control in the pots, the potentiometers that were in the back of the set, to reach the marketing goals.
And the marketing goals, of course, were to make the TV look good on the showroom floor.
That's right.
Or to be—I shouldn't say look good, but to look attractive,
to get your attention.
Yes.
And so what happened is I was one that discovered that those controls could be dialed back and that a really good picture could be obtained from the set. And what the marketing department discovered is the engineers had done that on purpose because they were retiring, and they thought it was their last chance to get a good TV set. And so they built a good TV set and then just included the range to get it to where marketing wanted to go.
But then, of course, when it got home, it needed to be reset and by someone like yourself to look good in the home.
Yes, we were telling everybody in the magazine, when you get this set, get it calibrated.
Right.
And of course, that suddenly created a demand for people to calibrate TV sets.
Thus, you started the Imaging Science Foundation, which trains people to do just that.
That's right. That's where it came from.
And when did that start?
The ISF's first seminar was in February of 1994. Mm-hmm. And so the official start was February of 1994.
And they're still at it today, even though you're not involved, as I understand.
That's right. I got out at the end of 1998.
Okay. And since then, or perhaps in conjunction with that, you also spent a lot of time over the years developing video test and evaluation discs, or programs, we might say.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that evolution.
Well, that's certainly the evolution of that actually was long before I went to work with the magazine. The evolution of that came from my chairing the SMPTE working group on professional and studio monitors. This was 1986. Mm-hmm. And what we were trying to do is get all of the post-production companies to conform to the system rules in producing program content. And they looked at me as chairman of the committee that was trying to get them to play by the rules. And they said, what's the point of our playing by the rules when the consumers don't play by the rules? And I had to point out that if they didn't play by the rules, the consumer would see an inconsistent wrong. In other words, if everybody in production played by the same set of rules, whatever the consumer saw, it would be consistently wrong. But if the production world played by their own set of rules, then everything the consumer was getting was chaos. So I managed, using that logic, I managed to convince post-production that they had to adhere to the rules. But they turned that on me and said, you're going to take responsibility for telling the consumer they also have to play by the rules. So in 1988, with the help of members of my committee, I created a Laserdisc called a Video Standard. And it was the first time that we know of that someone used video to describe how video is supposed to work.
What a concept.
Well, up to that point, everything was written down in paper.
Right, and mathematical formulas and so on and so forth.
Yes, there wasn't a video presentation that said, this is what it's supposed to look like. And, of course, we had gone through 2 years of figuring out how to describe the signal in terms of test signals. We had test signals for dynamic range, black to white. We had test signals for color. We had test signals for resolution. We had test signals for sharpness. So we used test signals to define the rules of the system. And then I put those test signals on a disk. And provided there was a 50-page book that came with a video standard. And we actually provided notes in that book saying this is what it's supposed to look like and put the video up and check to see if it's what it's supposed to be. So that that played well into my becoming, and that was part of the reason I became technical editor of a video magazine, was because I knew what the video was all about and I was already out there trying to tell consumers what they should be doing.
Right. And then that, of course, evolved into Video Essentials, which was your first DVD.
Yes. And Video Essentials actually represented the transition between composite and component. When we went to DVD, we went to this component video that we've just been talking about. Mm-hmm. And there was a great improvement in the quality of the picture. There were a lot of skeptics who didn't understand how a 12-centimeter disc could produce better video than a 12-inch disc. And they didn't understand digital compression. Mm. And they didn't understand what could be accomplished in the digital domain in compression. I mean, we could do 90 or 100 to 1 in digital compression without artifacts, and we couldn't. Interlace, as an example, is a 2-to-1 compression ratio, and it creates right. artifacts in the picture. So mm-hmm. an analog 2-to-1 compression ratio can sometimes look worse than a digital 100-to-1 compression ratio.
That's and quite amazing.
So people initially didn't grasp this. And so I did Video Essentials so that I could prove the transition between the 12-inch disc to mm-hmm. the 12-centimeter disc would be a vast improvement in picture quality.
Right. And so what was the difference then between Video Essentials and Digital Video Essentials, which is the next step?
Digital Video Essentials covered the transition from standard definition to high definition.
It was still on DVD originally, though, right? So it was still standard definition.
Right. That was how you compared standard definition. Of course, in high definition, I actually brought it out in the D Theater format.
And well, that's true.
I brought it out in D Theater, and then I brought it out in Windows Media Video.
Right. And for our listeners, D Theater was a format of digital VHS. It was actual tape. That yep. a couple of companies, JVC among them, made VCRs for DVHS. And yeah. D-Theater, I think, was a copy-protected format. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. D-Theater was a copy-protected format. And
so it was just like a it looked just like a regular VHS tape, which I was unhappy about only because I don't like tape generally. I mean, it suffers from wear and tear and... has physical contact with the heads and so on. Discs are so much nicer.
It's hard to find spots in the program. It's not anywhere near as interactive.
Right.
So, you know, I had to get something out in high definition, and D-Theater was the first format that allowed me to do that.
Right. And then Windows Media, you were able to make a program in there as well.
That's correct.
And then finally we had Digital Video Essentials HD Basics on both Blu-ray and HD DVD. I remember when that first came out on both formats.
Yes.
Which was quite amazing. And you had more trouble, I think, authoring Blu-ray, as I recall, than authoring HD DVD.
Yes. We were in a point, there is a program language for Blu-ray called Java.
Right.
Anybody who's played around with computers is familiar with the name, at least.
Sure.
And there weren't a lot of people that knew how to write scripts that were appropriate for Blu-ray. And so there were very few people that actually knew how to write interactivity in the Java script when I was creating the Blu-ray version of the program.
Right.
And it took an unbelievable effort to transform the HD DVD to the Blu-ray format just because I was asking them to do things that hadn't been done before.
Right.
They were in the specifications. Again, the system said I could do it.
The Blu-ray system in this case.
Yes, the Blu-ray system said I could do everything I wanted to do. It's just that no one had done it yet. And so it was months of... writing code and learning how to do what the system said you could do.
Right. And now you're working on something a little, yet the next step of evolution. But before we get to that, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Voice Activated Sync. Sync is a new system in Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. It listens to your voice, so without using your hands, you can make calls on your mobile phone, find and play music and podcasts, such as this one. Get turn-by-turn navigation and access real-time traffic and weather. I wish I had it in my car. All hands free from sync. For more details, visit syncmyridepodcast.com. Okay, so now you're working on something even beyond Digital Video Essentials HD Basics, and it's a little bit different. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, what I'm doing now is supporting a projector that I helped develop. I helped develop the 1080p DLP projector, and I'm trying to support it in the market, meaning trying to help people understand why it is so much better than anything else that's in the industry. When I go out and promote that projector, I start my presentation by saying, this is a video projector, and everything else that you look at, or almost everything else you look at, is not. Everything else is, it's a DLP projector, it's an LCOS projector, it's an LCD projector, but it's not a video projector. And so I, of course, am putting together test patterns that help make it easy to understand when something is a video device and when it's not a video device.
And by now, video device, you're talking about whether or not it conforms to the rules that we've been talking
that's
about.
That's correct. That's it. I'm just saying the object of the display device is to accurately reproduce the video system. And it doesn't matter what the technology is. It
Sure.
has a responsibility to accurately reproduce the video system.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, I'm putting together test signals in an order that makes it easy to understand what's going on in the display device.
Mm-hmm.
These test signals have been out before. They came out on HD-DVD in a program called Test and Demonstration Materials that I put out on the market.
I didn't know about that
one. But you see, people don't have HD-DVD players anymore.
So, well, I do.
yeah, so do I.
I think you do too, yes.
yes, and my HD-DVD collection is fairly large.
Yes,
but that said, the dealers who are trying to promote the projector, what sets it apart from everything else in the market is that it's a video projector. And so they asked me to organize test signals in an order that would make it simple for them to do a presentation for consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, included on this disc, I have managed to get a hold of some demonstration material for which I have a license to use for demonstration, but I cannot sell it, nor can I give it away.
Mm.
So initially, with this demonstration material, which the broadcast community is well familiar, I can loan this disc to the dealers so that they can use the demonstration material,
mm-hmm.
but I can't give it to them, and I can't sell it to them because of copyright restrictions.
Understood.
So I'm initially developing this for the dealer market.
Now, right,
I'm
sure.
also at the same time working on getting a license to at least some of the demonstration material. I'm hoping that I'm able to show the value of this to the copyright owners to a mm-hmm. point where they will give me a license to sell the material.
Yeah.
And so this is a chicken or egg type of thing. If I don't demonstrate the viability of having this in the consumer market, I'm never going to get a license.
Sure.
So I'm taking this one step at a time, and I'm producing it. I'm making it available to dealers. I am obviously going to publicize this copyrighted material to a point where I'm anticipating a demand for it,
mm-hmm.
and it is my hope that eventually I can convince the copyright owners to give me a license to sell this material.
Now, I don't think there's any reason not to mention the material that you have that you can't sell or give away.
No, there is. I don't think so.
One of them is the ABC, some ABC football clips, I believe.
Right. In fact, on the 21st of December, 1998, some Philips cameras were brought in from Europe, 720p cameras, and they brought two of them in, and by the time they arrived, neither one of them worked, and they had to cannibalize both cameras to get one of them to work.
Wow.
And they did a single camera shoot of the Miami versus Denver game that was held in Miami on the 21st of December. And so from this single camera shoot evolved material that convinced ABC to do Monday Night Football in high definition the following season. So this was day one of Monday Night Football, where we had a single camera out on the field, and anyway, I have a copy of edited footage from that single camera shoot.
Right.
And so when people see this, their reaction is they're not used to seeing pictures that good today. And, of course, I'm showing those pictures on my display device, which I'd like to believe is partially responsible for the fact that they are seeing better pictures than they've ever seen before. The second set of material was put together in 2004 by the American Society of Cinematographers and the Digital Cinema Initiative.
DCI, it's often called.
Yeah, DCI. ASC DCI.
Yes.
And these two organizations were looking forward to a time when electronic imaging would be the dominant source of images in motion picture theaters. And they shot some material that ultimately became a piece of reference material that every theater owner who has electronic has an electronic cinema system, has a copy of this. So in theory, I should be able to walk into the theater and say, play the standard evaluation material.
And which by the way, is often called STEM, standard evaluation material.
Yeah, the ST comes from standard, the E from evaluation, the M from material.
It's often referred to as STEM. Just in case any listeners hear it referred to that way, they'll know what it means.
Yes. And so the license for this material is highly limited. It's basically limited to demonstration purposes only and for electronic imaging. Well, I figure that I'm doing electronic imaging and I'm doing demonstrations. So I pulled the electronic master. The material was shot on 35 and 65 millimeter motion picture film, and then was transferred to the 4K electronic domain.
And okay, so it was scanned. It was scanned into a 4K image, which is roughly 4,096 pixels by across by 2160 down.
Whatever 235 is, just divide 4096 by 235, and you'll get the number of pixels high.
Right. Right, 2.35.
And actually 2.39 is the aspect
is
ratio.
It's actually more accurate,
Yeah, it is actually 2.39.
Okay.
But in any event, what happened to, it was transferred to the digital intermediate format, which is something that happens to a lot of motion picture films.
Most films go through that stage, do they not?
Well, I'm not going to say most films, but certainly a lot of films go through the digital intermediate stage.
Okay.
And then post-production is done in the digital intermediate stage, and then that 4K image is read back out to film, and then the film is distributed. Now, that 4K and a down conversion to 2K is made available to motion picture theaters with electronic projectors. mm-hmm. so that they can project the digital image rather than the film image.
Sure.
So what I did is I acquired a license to the 2K image that was intended for electronic cinema.
Right.
And then I had to decide how to get that to 1080p. The 2K is 2048. It's actually 2048 by 857 because it's a 239 aspect ratio.
Right, okay.
But I had to make a decision about how to get the 2K to 1080p. And it
you
turns
could,
out...
One could certainly just down convert.
Yes, but it turns out that that conversion is really difficult because you're going from 2048 to 1920. And it's a very small conversion.
Yes.
And so among the things that I'm doing on this disc is I'm taking a 1920 center cut out of the 2048.
So and you're trimming a bit off the sides.
Yes, yes. We're losing a little bit off the left and right.
I'm taking just a trim on the sides, please.
Yes. So I'm losing a little bit of the sides. It goes from a 2.39 to a 2.24 aspect ratio in doing that. But what I'm discovering is that it's really easy to see how badly the image is degraded when you downconvert it as opposed to taking a center cut.
And you're putting both on this disc, right? You're putting
That's
the center
correct.
Cut version and the downconverted version so you can see the difference.
Oh, yeah. With my projector, it's really easy to see the difference between the two. And so I'm doing this partially because I'm not convinced that the industry knows what kind of damage is occurring when they convert 2K to 1080p. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of masters that are being done in 2K at the moment.
Right.
And certainly... I know some of the studios are actually doing center cuts out of the 2K. They master in 2K, mm-hmm. and then they do center cuts out of the 2K for video presentations. But other studios are down converting that 2K.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I first heard that they were doing that, I said, no, that's never going to work. And now I'm out to prove it.
Right.
And so that's among the things I'm doing. It helps, don't take this the wrong way, but it helps sell the projector because people are seeing things they've never seen before.
Right, right. I have no trouble, by the way, mentioning who the projector is from, if you're okay with that.
Yes. The projector is manufactured by Samsung, and I spent a great deal of time consulting on that product from the very beginning, before the concept of a projector was even envisioned, or it was envisioned, but before design one got started on the projector, I went in and started video classes for the engineers who were building the projector.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing they had to know is what the goals were.
Right. What the rules were.
Yes. So we started right off, and I learned a lot from Samsung, and I learned a lot about why TV sets are the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can tell this story, I'd like to.
Sure.
Samsung has a video research department. I thought, oh, good, this is where I want to start. I want to start with the video research department. And so I got into this department and found out what they do. They sample human factors. In other words, they will take 5 TV sets and they'll put them all in a row and they will bring in an audience and they've misadjusted each one of these 5 TV sets. And they survey consumers and have consumers rate which set that they like the best.
Mm-hmm.
And they develop a bell-shaped curve. And they take the peak of that bell-shaped curve over to engineering and say, build this.
Huh.
And so they did this for me. And they did this in the morning. And I said, okay, guys, go away to lunch. And I'm not having lunch today. And I stayed in the room. And what I did is I changed the environment of the room. You know, they had incandescent lighting on wooden walls, mm-hmm. and I brought in a neutral background and lit it up at daylight. We brought the same people in, and they looked at it again, and the bell-shaped curve was in a completely different place. And the video people looked at me dumbfounded, and I said, why do you think each manufacturer comes up with their own formula for what they think is going to sell? I said, how is it that you think that multiple manufacturers can be doing the exact same research that you're doing and come up with different answers? Well, turns out it's the environment.
Yeah.
And they looked at me dumbfounded. I said, okay, now that you get this, I'm going to turn this around on you and say, the only thing you can do to make it good is to adhere to the rules of the system, to mm-hmm. do it the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And they took your words to heart, apparently.
Well, it worked in the projector because the projector is the one of the finest displays that we've ever seen.
Sure. And we will mention quickly that it went through a number of generations. I remember reviewing one of the early ones in 720p,
right.
and it has since moved on to 1080p and been two or three generations of that now?
Yes. There were three generations in 720p, and we're now on our second generation in 1080p.
And that is the, do you remember the model number?
Yes. It's SP-A900
is
the second generation. The A800 is still on the market. The difference between the two is the contrast ratio. The contrast ratio on the 900 is about 35% better mm-hmm. than the 800. For people who can't control their viewing environment, the 800 is just fine.
Who can or cannot control their viewing environment.
Yes. If there's a lot of light in the viewing environment, the 800 is a good enough choice. If you can tightly control the environment, then the 900 is going to produce a much better picture.
Okay. Well, I have seen a number of these Samsung projectors, including the 900, and I have to say, without being obsequious at all, that they really do look spectacular, which, of course, depends on the screen. And that was the next point I wanted to get to.
Well, the irony of building the best projector I could possibly build is that once it was built, I realized that the screen was limiting my ability to show the projector. That I couldn't easily find among any manufacturers of screens, I couldn't easily find a screen that allowed me to show what the projector was capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this isn't the first time I've run into this. Back in the CRT days, in the very early 90s...
CRT projectors we're talking about.
Yes, in CRT projectors in the early 90s, I recognized that there weren't screens out there that were good enough for me to see what the projector was doing. Mm-hmm. And so I got involved in screen technology in the early 90s and developed a set of screens that was appropriate for the kinds of things that we were doing at the time.
With CRT projectors.
Pardon?
With CRT projectors.
Correct. By the time we got to the DLP projector, it was so much better than anything I've ever done in the CRT domain that the weaknesses of the screen were, again, the limiting factor in mm-hmm. my ability to show what was going on.
Right. And what was it that so much better about DLP compared to CRT? Because a lot of people I know who grew up with CRT projectors say, oh, you can't get better blacks, and oh, that's the best color, and you got to have a controlled room, but so on and so forth. And they tend to sort of diss DLP a little bit. I'm not among them, but I hear a lot of people talk about that. How do you respond?
And well, first of all, I totally agree with you that a CRT can generate better black levels than anything else out there because you are almost anything else out there because you can legitimately shut the light off in a CRT.
Right.
So I'm not even going to argue the black level issue. CRT will win.
But DLP offered enough other benefits to you that you were an advocate there.
Right. One of them was resolution.
Mm.
And, you know, we talk about a CRT and its resolution capability. In order to do 1080p in a CRT, you needed a 9-inch electromagnetically focused CRT. In other words, it was a projector that was in the $30,000 to $40,000 range. In order to do 1080p, and we know that it was rolling off the 1080p in frequency response. It wasn't going flat out to the limit of 1080p. The higher frequencies were not being reproduced at the amplitude of lower frequencies.
Right.
So as much as the detail was on the screen, it was not on the screen at the right amplitude. That all changed with DLP.
Gotcha.
When we went to DLP, it basically could do single pixel transitions at almost full amplitude. Some of the measurements we've made, there is maybe a 4 or 5% fall off in amplitude at single pixel transitions. So it's effectively, you can't see 4 or 5%. You can't see that kind of difference.
Right.
And so it's effectively flat out to 1920 by 1080.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that kind of resolution in the image was interfering with the surface coat on the screen.
Mm.
Most screens are a vinyl backing that are spray coated. The reflective characteristics are sprayed onto the vinyl. And it turns out that the granularity or the corrosivity of the spray that was going on the screen was actually interfering with the 1920 by 1080 resolution and was actually, as detail in the picture would move across the granularity in the screen, you would see noise in the picture.
Wow, that wasn't in the signal.
That's correct. And
that's
the
incredible.
Picture appeared to be noisy. Now, the post-production community was the first to beat me over the head with that when they told me that as much as they recognized they had to use a projector to see what they were doing in 1920 by 1080, they weren't using the projector because of the amount of noise. And then the other problem they had was the uniformity of the image. Most screens that were out there are pretty high gain, and they hotspot, and they color shift. I'm not sure the post-production industry recognized that was all the screen's fault, but they looked at the image and said, there's no way we can use a projector to look at high definition.
Right.
And I said, yes, but you have to use a projector because the image has to be a minimum size before you can see what's going on.
Right, sure.
So I looked at that and said, it's the screen that's causing the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I approached multiple manufacturers about building basically the antithesis of something they have ever built in their entire history. Now, I say that most screen companies are in the business of compensating for problems that occur either in the environment of the display or in the display itself.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, if I go back to the 1980s, the first screen I had for a projector was an aluminized curved screen that had a gain of 15. And the CRT projector, it was a Thompson three-tube CRT. The Thompson projector that I was using didn't have enough light. The screen was probably no more than 6 feet wide, had a gain of 15, and that's what it took for us to be able to see an acceptable image brightness-wise out of that CRT projector. So what's happened is screen manufacturers, for their entire history, have been building screens that compensate for problems in either the environment itself or in the display device.
Right.
In much more modern history, we had a problem of the lamps that were being used in lamp-based projectors were said not to have enough red.
Mm.
So what happened is screen manufacturers started making their screens plus red so that they,
so that they would reflect more red than blue or green.
That's right. What they were doing is they were applying a fixed solution to a variable problem. I mean, the lack of red was a lamp-to-lamp issue. And yet
wasn't the same from one projector to another.
Right. And depending on the optics in the projector, it could be different from one brand to another. So here we've got these screen companies offering a fixed solution to a variable problem. Well, it turns out that that fixed solution introduced color errors. If a screen shifts, or if a screen reflects red more than it reflects any other color, then the picture that you shine on the screen is going to be tinted red.
Yes, yes.
And what happens is if you move your head, if you put a still frame up on the screen and move your head, you'll see a shift in the color because the gain in red is higher than the gain is in blue and green. So as you go off axis, you'll see a change in color. And
now, we should mention briefly that gain is a technical term referring to projection screens that relates the amount of light hitting the screen versus the amount of light being reflected back. And you might think that if the gain is greater than 1, as you said, this early silver screen of yours had a gain of 15, you might wonder, well, how are we getting more light off the screen than we're putting onto the screen? And the answer is that you're not. But
well, the answer is that the light is being being focused back at a single point instead of being equally dispersed everywhere.
Correct.
That in that gain of 15 screen, if I got 20 degrees off center, I didn't have any light.
Right. The light was going back in one direction towards the center, towards the middle of the...
It's like a big satellite dish. You've seen these great big huge satellite dishes that collect energy from outer space.
Right.
Well, they focus that energy all in one point, and that's where the antenna is out at the focal point of the parabola.
Of the parabola.
And so we're basically doing the same thing with the screen. We're focusing light to a single point.
Right, or to a narrower area, at least, depending on the gain of the screen.
Right. Obviously, if a gain is very high, the focus is to a very narrow point. If the gain is low, then the focus is to a much wider area. And one of the misconceptions when we talk about screens, as an example, if I talk about a 0.9 gain screen, well, 9/10. That must be a really low gain screen. In reality, if a screen hotspot, it's a high gain screen. It doesn't matter. It can be a gray screen, which can absorb light, but it can have a high gain surface so that only certain people see that light.
Right.
You know, only people on axis see that light. So we, among the things in coming up with a new screen and coming up with a new way of looking at screens, I'm actually having to come up with new parameters to describe a screen because all these old numbers that we're used to hearing don't apply when you're trying to build a screen that is flat and does nothing more than show you what the projector is doing.
Right, right. And so you went to a number of companies, and finally you got a hit at Daylight.
Yes.
And they said to you, you know what, you're making sense. We like what you're talking about. Let's do something.
They actually trusted me. When I went in and said I want to build this, the initial reaction is what you want to build is the exact opposite of anything we've ever been asked to build.
Yeah.
But we trust who you are, and we'll go ahead and we'll build the screen to your specifications.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I did is I brought in my projector, and I put my projector on that screen, and they looked at the picture, And they said, you knew this was going to happen, didn't you? Because that's the best picture we've ever seen. I have to be honest with you. I'm going to be honest with you and tell you that I didn't know. I knew the change needed to be made, but I didn't know how badly that change needed to be made until I saw it for myself.
Wow. Wow.
I knew the screen was getting in my way. I didn't know how much it was getting in the way until I took it out of the way.
Now we have the Daylight Affinity screen.
Yes. That was even a surprise to me.
That's amazing to me, actually.
Yeah. I wasn't prepared for how big the difference was going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew it had to happen, but because I had never seen it, no one had ever seen it.
Sure.
Because I hadn't seen it, I didn't know exactly what to expect. I knew it was going to be better, but I had no idea how much better it was going to be.
And I have to say that I have seen this screen at CES and CEDIA now, and I am also quite impressed. And I look forward to seeing it again. You're going to be at CES this year,
in the
Daylight booth, demonstrating the Samsung projector on the Daylight screen.
Yes.
And I'm really, really looking forward to that, and it's just coming up here very shortly.
Oh, yes, it is.
So at this point, I'm going to say thank you very much to my guest geek, Joe Kane, for his invaluable insight into video. Whenever I'm with you, Joe, I just try to keep my ears wide open because everything you say is very interesting and I learn a lot every time. So thanks very much.
You.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I very much appreciate the time here. And good luck to everybody out in the audience in getting really good pictures.
There we go. Thank you very much. We're going to get you back, Joe, when we figure out the video situation with Skype. Because I know there's plenty more for us to talk about.
Thank you.
Next week, my guest is scheduled to be Ann Parsons, Senior Vice President of Advanced Product Development at Pioneer and a spokesman for the Blu-ray Disc Association. We'll be talking about the just-completed 3D spec for Blu-ray, so be sure to catch that one. Until then, geek out.